The title of, you probably know, I have to remind myself, is to cultivate calming ourselves, calming and steadying our attention, which is a generic enough title that I can do that. It's not that I only do that once in a while. So what I'm doing for this weekend is I've come up with seven practices, really practices. They're ideas, but then they're ways to practice which support this calming. And I talked about all seven of them last night. What I'm going to do is we're going to focus on two of them this morning, and two of them this afternoon, and two of them tomorrow morning, and one of them and reviewing tomorrow afternoon. So it will be a thorough weekend in that way. And so how I'm going to do it is describe these two now at the beginning of this session. And then for the morning, you're going to be sitting and walking and sitting, a little bit more walking, those two. And then we'll have a Q&A session at the end of the morning and see how it went and what questions you've had and how did that work and get some sort of feedback and shared comments. Same thing in the afternoon. I'll introduce what we're going to do for the afternoon. You'll do it all afternoon and then we'll have a Q&A session about how that went and what happened and at the end of the afternoon. And we'll do the same thing tomorrow. So that's the sort of four quadrants. Sound okay? And therefore, I do different things in different ways, meet with people. So I won't be doing group meetings because we'll all just have a session at each one of those. Otherwise, it's just too much talking. That gives you a good solid, you know, hour and a half or so, 2 hours in the middle of each session to practice it. And as it's about practicing it, then that's when you get to practice it. So I know you like to hear the Dharma. We all do too. So there'll be both those sessions of talking and then your practice, quiet time in the middle, where we'll just be silent and do your practice. Okay. Let's see. So let me introduce them and then I'll talk about how you're going to practice them. So these are, how much to review? We are not calm. As a general rule, we're not calm inside, even though we know we like it and it feels nice when we're calmer. For many reasons, completely understandable reasons, our general state of well-being is not particularly calm. It's agitated. And it's normalized, and we have no idea that that's what it's like until we try and be quiet and just calm down and sit still, and we realize we're just, the mind will not settle down. Thich Nhat Hanh called that the frog principle. You put a frog on a plate. I've never put a frog on a plate, but if you put a frog on anything, it will just jump off. It won't stay there. So we're trying to develop froglessness. That's his way of describing it. Like, not so jumpy. And it's not easy because we're so used to and we're so stimulated and we're also so anxious about, you know, life is tricky and life is unpredictable and we're anxious beings. That's how we've survived so well. And the other thing is that we are, all of us human, the human mind has learned that if it is busy and jumpy, it's not just busy and jumpy, like random busy jumpy, it's busy jumpy trying to make things better. It's, you know, it's really trying to help by, oh, I've got to watch out for that. Oh, be careful, this is happening. Oh, I must remember to do that. And, oh, that was so difficult. Why did that happen anyway? And it's like that, always trying to take care of the variety, the endless bombardment of impulses and inputs and, you know, experiences that happen both outside ourselves, to ourselves, and inside ourselves. We remember this, and we have a flash of that, and so on. And so we are busy trying to alleviate distress, but what happens is we just get more distressed because we get all sort of wound up, worried about this and that, and so we're not very good at helping ourselves, even though all we're doing is trying to help ourselves all the time, being busy. It's pretty sad. We're really in a bit of a mess, and we're all in this mess together, and it sort of works, and it definitely works for survival, which is why there are so many of us. And we're all, you know, we've got all of our electricity and our plumbing organized, and, you know, we're able to get a lot of things together. We have a lot of things together. It's extraordinary when you think we began in caves and stuff, you know. Amazing what humans have achieved, but we haven't achieved froglessness, that's the thing. You know, we've achieved all this at the cost of an inner, endless tension. And that's getting worse. And it's getting worse partly because we have so many things now to deal with. You know, if you didn't have that many things, there's a great story in a book that Christina Feldman and Jack Kornfield wrote years and years ago. Soul Food, I think the name of the book, but it doesn't matter. And it's a story of an American businessman on holiday in Turkey. This is a long time ago, before all of Turkey, you know, distress that's happening and so on now. And he was on a beach somewhere or other, and in his holiday, and he was sitting back, leaning against an upturned boat, which is really nice, comfortable. And after some time, a local person came and sat and leaned against the boat near him, and they got into a conversation. And turned out that the local man was the owner of the boat, and he was a fisherman. And this was now the middle of the day, it was the afternoon. And so the businessman was asking him, you know, about his life, and he'd go out early in the morning was the best time to go fishing, then he'd take the fish to the market, and then that was it for the day. And so the American was saying to him, why don't you do it twice? I mean, could you go, is there fish at other times of day and stuff? And he said, yeah, I could. Well, you know, why don't you do that? And so then they got into this thing where the local guy is saying, well, why would I? And he said, well, then you could have twice as much fish. Well, why would I want twice as much? Then you could have twice as much money. Why would I want twice as much money? Then you could have twice as many people, and then, why would I want to do that, you know? And in the end, he's like, well, then you could do whatever you wanted. And he said, I am. I don't need to do more so I can sit here and on my boat. It's a great story. So it's that, you know, in the modern era, it's more and more, and got to have more and get more and do more and then pay for it and then rearrange it and deal with it and on and on. And it's got fast recently, like crazy fast. So of course you're agitated. So for all those reasons, we need to calm ourselves down. And it's not just that we need to calm ourselves down because calm is right. It's what we're doing in meditation. And we need not to lose sight of this. So you need to remind yourself over and over, is the whole point of meditating, training the mind, is to enable the possibility of unhooking this busy sense, this active mind, which is trying to make you comfortable, which is your SOS, I call it these days, your separate sense of self. That selfing behavior trying to help you is trying to help you be content, peaceful, happy, loving, open, present. Everything the Buddha taught, everything, is about freeing ourselves. You've heard all this. Freeing ourselves from what? Freeing ourselves from the agitated state of the selfing, which is trying always to improve things so you can feel better. So it's a habituated mode of living that we're trying to free ourselves from. Because that mode, that separate sense of self, with the agenda of trying to help, is what's causing the agitation. In the name of trying to help. So it's not a wrong thing that we do. But it doesn't do it, because it's an agitated way of doing things. It's also a futile way, because it's endlessly trying to get rid of what it can't get rid of, hang on to what it can't keep, you know, prevent itself from having old age, sickness and death, which is completely unpreventable, for instance, and keeping the things which it likes, which will disappear and break and change, and which is impossible. So a lot of what it's doing in the name of helping is futile, ineffective, and jumpy and exhausting. So we're in a dilemma here. So the point of the calming and why we want to be calmer is we want to be able to understand by seeing that behavior. We want to see that separate sense of self, feel it, feel its operation going on, feel its jumpiness and nerviness and controlling and disappointment and judging. Feel how that's making you feel. And get to realize that actually isn't helping. That way is feels distressing. And when that isn't doing it, when I'm having a sunset moment, an aha moment, a moment where there's not much going on, that's actually what I'm wanting, that sense of freedom from this busy churning activity. So we need the calm in order to see the no calm, to see the agitation coming and going, the behavior. if we're not calm, I said this last night, and I thought that was a brilliant analogy. I've learned it's the first time I said it, so this is the second time I'm saying it as an example, is that Skype, I don't like Skyping. I have a number of times I'm communicating with students because I live in a relatively isolated island. I have to do it by technology. And so I prefer the phone to the Skype. But the Skype is free and the phone isn't free for lots of people, so that's international call rates, so that's, The trouble with Skype, at least in my experience, is that you're connected and you can see and you can talk, and then you drop it, it breaks, it cuts out for a while, and then you miss a bit, and then you talk a bit more, and then you miss a bit. And it's a very unsatisfactory connection that way, and so I don't really get the connection. It just keeps breaking up. Well, that's what happens when our minds are jumpy and nervy and not calm, is you don't really know what's going on inside here, because you only just get little bits and pieces of it. If the mind is calm, it's like having a good Skype connection, good phone connection. You now really can see what you're trying to see. And it's the calm enabling not just a glimpse of seeing, which is a superficial bit, but the unfolding of the scenario. Then you understand the whole thing. Otherwise, or a movie, you're seeing just a bit of this and a bit of this. You can't follow the plot, right? You can't get it. So we need to follow the plot and get it and see how this is being this human being with this mind and heart. And so the steadiness is required to understand. The understanding is required to increasingly not keep doing what upsets us, not have to keep paying the price of agitation. And then when we understand, we don't keep getting caught in the behavior that's distressing ourselves. We find ourselves extricated. We find ourselves not perpetuating. We don't do that, but we don't perpetuate it. But that's not possible until you understand. That's not possible till you see steadily, which is not possible until you're calm. So it's a process that we need calming. Plus it feels good, instead of being agitated, which we know is exhausting. So, in order to calm ourselves down, we can use these same busy minds in a way that's supportive instead of a way that's undermining. And the two which I'll begin with for today, which I talked about last night, I'm wanting you to practice this morning. The first one is to count blessings. And it doesn't mean count blessings, but it means invite into your awareness some of the things, experiences, memories, people, good things in your life which nourish us. Because one of the primary causes of this anxiety is that we're not content with it right now as it is. We need a little more something, a little more time to get a little more something done. We need to get rid of something or other. We need to change this a little bit. We need to have a few more retreats. We need more of this, more of this. We're always hungry. It's the behavior of hungry activity. Hunger. The Buddha called it tanha, T-A-N-H-A, thirst. We're motivated by need. So what we need is the opposite, because that's one of the motivations for this agitation, stress. And so we need to feed that hunger. When anyone has had the meal, it's just like, oh, that was great. It's this, the slaking of the appetite, the satisfying of the appetite. So this aspect of agitation and not calm, which is the hunger, the wanting, the next this, more of that, we need to feed it. And how we feed it is with the things which are already available to us, which inspire us. Hi, Erica. Nice to see you. So what is in your life? And there are a million things in our lives, but the tendency is to focus on what we need to address, to fix, to rearrange. We've got to get this, we've got to get rid of that. And we don't have to get rid of, we already have fantastic sight. We have these amazing faculties and these incredible bodies. We have people in our lives who are really there for us. We have intelligence. We have honor. We have a certain sense of ethical, goodness. We have plumbing, as I said last night. You know, we have clean streets. We have like a telephone that can dial 911 when we have a heart attack. We have so much, you know, our particular privileged society, this era. We live in a place where the air is lovely. We don't have to wear masks every day to breathe, you know. It's spring. We have, you know, we don't have to do anything about it. And then life is re-emerging. There's so much. And each of one, you know, each of us will have our own ways which nourish us. So you need to do some nourishing. And your system will be able to feast. And it isn't just a quick thought. It's the point of practicing this is to abide. I love that word. Meaning to, I also like the word savor. It's very, I'm very sensory. That's what I think Krista was talking about, a feminine approach, but anyway, sensory style to practice the Dharma. But we need to feed on and incorporate the experience of gratitude, of appreciation, of there's a blessing. So you don't just think of a plumbing, oh, what a great idea, I love that, turning on the tap and that hot water comes out just like that. No wells, no slugging around with buckets on my back. Amazing. But we need to live for, extend the moments of the effect of that reflection. Let that in and slowly seep into how you know it. We need to know it. We need to experience the nourishing impact of that thought. And then another thought. So you do this all really slowly and you extend out so you're experiencing increasing satisfaction for a time as you meditate. So this isn't just what you do in meditation, but as you meditating, of course, now some of you are newer, have had a little bit of it, if introduction, most of you have had some training in meditation and some of you tons of meditation. We are meditating, meaning being mindful, first of all. Okay, so that means our awareness is directed to this present moment's experience, not off in our thinking, wondering, remembering, fantasizing, but what is right here. There are two things that happen then when we do that. We're here, and the input that we're now aware of is what's actually happening in my knee, and you know, I'm sitting in this chair, and we're in this environment, and these sounds are happening. The senses are giving us information, which is real now. But the other thing that's happening when that happens, and only when that happens, which is incredible, is that there's another part of your awareness which knows that that's what's happening. When your mind goes off to Paris, I always say, because I do like Paris, or wherever it's going, off shopping or off whatever, remembering the fight you just had or something, you don't know it. That knowing part of your mind is not there. The part that's doing the fighting or the remembering is doing its thing fine, that part of the brain, but the big part that knows it isn't, until you're present again. And when you're present again, it's like your two minds are now functioning, the busy little one and then the one that's over the top going like, oh, look, I'm present here. I can feel my knees now. That knowing bit, that's our wisdom. And so we're wanting that part. So meditation is training that. Training to access and then, again, abide. Extend the moments of present knowing. That's what mindfulness is, basically. That present knowing is quiet. Isn't controlling, liking, judging, trying to get more of or less of. It's not busy. It's just simply sitting back. Ah, knowing what's happening. That's what we're growing and cultivating in meditation. So you're going to meditate being present. And to stay present, I know this is back to the basics, but we all need the basics forever, remind ourselves. What helps us be present is to feel what's present, and the body is the best way to do that. So you anchor your attention somehow in some aspect of what feeling in the present moment, your body. Three ways, which I typically teach these days, arenas to give your attention to are your hands. Very interesting hands, millions of nerves, very sensitive. An awful lot can be felt. The point of interest, the reason I say very interesting, these hands, is to stay in the present moment is not easy. The thinking mind wants to take you away. So if you have something that's interesting, you're more likely to stay present with it. So if it's boring, it's not going to keep your attention for long. Your fantasies are way more juicy, and so you'll go there. Okay, so the present hands, because they have got so many nerves in them, you can feel tons of things. You can feel what they're touching, cloth, flesh, or air. You can feel what is, if a hand is touching a hand as you sit there. You can feel if it's warm or cool, and sometimes it's a bit of both. It's more sensation on this side than on this side of a hand. Not much in the very middle, but a lot on the pads and tons on the tips, and the most around the edges of the nails. That's where they're really sensitive, which is why, you know, I got a splinter up a nail, you know, one time. I was sweeping like this on my, and I got this great big thing. I had to go to the hospital. It was like really agony. Very, very sensitive, the nails. You can feel that. And then you can feel inside your hands. You can feel the weight of them, the tension of them, the puffy, squishy, moist softness of them, the hard, bony, dry part of them. And you can feel inside even more that they're tingling and pulsing. Sometimes you can feel they're throbbing. You can feel more tingling in some areas than other areas and so on. There's a lot of information which you can, which helps keep your attention present. That's one. Another one is your breathing, which of course most people teach in meditation. Buddha practiced awareness of his breath every day of his life till he died. Because again, there's lots of information in your breathing. It's very interesting. Once you can give it some attention, you're likely to be able to stay noticing. This is one thing that I'm very visual. My mind is, when I experience anything, hear anything, feel anything, think anything, I have image going on with it. It's fascinating. Like I can't even count numbers without seeing them floating in a shape in space and everything. Okay, the days of the week are a D shape, with Saturday and Sunday being the straight, and then the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, the five is the loop of the D, for instance. So it's Tuesday, I'm at this point on my D, you know, that's how my mind works. It's crazy. It's just the way it is. So with breathing, I don't just feel the breath coming in, I see the breath coming in, and what I see is a little bit of breath coming in at the beginning, and then a lot coming in, and then it's flooding in, and then it's pouring in, and then it's less of it, and less of it, and then it's less and less until it's fading away, but there's still a bit of breath coming in, and then it stops. And there's no breath coming in, and then it's beginning gently, and then it's getting bigger, and then it's a lot, and it's just about over the zenith, and it's now beginning to be less, and it's trailing away until it's... And I can watch that. It's just the way it is for me. But it's interesting, because it isn't just in, out, like that. It absolutely isn't. And sometimes it's very light, like that. Sometimes it's like a bellows, and there's a lot going on. Sometimes it's uneven, if there's emotion there. It's, for instance, I'm just giving examples that it's possible to perceive, like hands. So that's why it's used as an anchor, because it's really interesting. I did a training once, a Tibetan style of Western Tibetan person training, that you do 7-point training. The beginning of the in-breath, the middle of the in-breath, the end of the in-breath, the gap between the beginning of the out-breath, the middle of the out-breath, and the end of the out-breath. And you pick out each one of those things. That's extremely hard work, but it actually really keeps you very present. It gets a lot of concentration. So, for instance, I mean, that's possible. Even just the beginning of the breath and then the end. And you discover that the end of the in-breath is the same thing as the beginning of the out-breath. It's one and the same. But the end of the out-breath, nothing happens for a brief time before the next in-breath happens. There's a gap there. And it's possible to perceive it pretty easily. You don't have to be that quiet to perceive that. For instance, it doesn't matter about whether there's a breath or a gap or not a gap. It's about interest. It's about being present, being curious. That's the point. Because we're trying to train present awareness. The third one is hearing, which is in itself a lovely practice because there's an openness of it, and you're not doing anything there, and you're just receiving, like with the hands, you're just receiving the information, coming and going of sounds randomly, close or far or long, and they're so not personal. Your breath is more personal. It's easy to get into, oh, I'm uptight, my breath is all struggly. Whereas hearing, it's like, I can't take it personally just because there's a sound, a truck or a gurgle for the person beside me. It's not personal. My stomach's gurgling. I can't really take that on. Anyway, we're anchoring yourself in the present moment. That's what we're going to practice as you practice meditation. But today, what you're going to practice in the beginning is, and with the beginning of your practice sitting time, you'll take 10 minutes or 15 minutes and do some blessings counting. and do some reflecting on what is it in your life that nourishes you? What are some things? And slowly stay there and savor them. So you start with the content, a memory or an image or whatever it is, a person or whatever. You call them, invite it. You savor that. You stay with that. And then you go from the thing itself, which you're paying attention to you shift your attention and to recognize the impact. What is this affecting? How is this being how is this affecting me? Can you feel your shoulders go down, or your eyes widen, or your jaw relax, your hands relax? Can you feel a warmth filling your heart? Like it's all different for everybody. Can you feel that sense of like gratitude? Gratitude. Oh, that deliciousness of it. Feel the effect of the experience of it. It's the experience that I'm after. Experience that. And then after 10 or 15 minutes or something, just be with your hands or whatever you're doing, your breathing. And you'll find you can really be there much more and longer because you're not hungry off hunting for something. Right? You're now post the kill of the lion, and now you actually can just be here for a lot longer with your breathing. It's more interesting. You can stay. You're more. So notice how the effect is in your system. And then after some time, when you're back in Paris or whatever you're doing, and you're not really present again, do it again. And call up something that's nourishing you. Reflect for a few minutes, moments, whatever. You experiment with how you do it. Meditating's an art. You have to refine it for yourself. If you're more upset or agitated, you have to do more of soothing yourself. So this is the nourishing period. That's the one thing to do. And then the other thing we're going to do is, which order are we going to do this in? Yeah, this is the other part we're also going to do this morning. Because then I'll stop talking and you're just going to do this. You're going to practice. Is that we aren't just hungry, we are insecure. Life is not trustworthy because it's always shifting and changing. And so on the whole, we very easily get into this sense of insecurity. Unpredictability, unreliability, just when we thought we had things all together, the ducks were all in a row, the end duck falls off, something happens. And this happens quickly and sometimes enormously. It's a huge change in life, or it's just a little piece of news. It's like, oh, I was going to go and see that person and now they've gone to hospital and I can't see them. Or, you know, they've cancelled the show I was going to go to. Or it's like, oh, all of a sudden you have to change again. So life is like that, always shifting underneath. It's like walking on quicksand. It's not trustworthy. And that adds to this agitation. Because you know really it's not as safe. And so that makes us even more try and make it safe and plan things and predict things and organize things. And we work even harder because it keeps shifting. It's trying to herd kittens. It's ridiculous. It's exhausting. So what is it in your experience that you do trust, that you don't have to constantly rearrange, that isn't kitten-like? You know, what is there that's actually stable? And there are things in your life. This isn't that different from the other one, but this isn't just about nourishing you. This is about reassuring you that you can give yourself to, that you can trust. And they may be the same thing as the first exercise, it's fine. But there are certain things which are completely reliable. And when you have a sense of trust, it's about trusting. When we trust things, not just are nourished by them, but actually can really trust them, there's a solid feeling. There's a feeling, I can let down into this. And so what are some of those things? It might not be the same things. Chocolate isn't that trustworthy, even though it's very nourishing, for, you know, for the pleasure senses at least. But what is it that really gives you a sense of safety, trust? And it would be, for instance, things like, for me, I said this last night, the cycling of nature, the rhythm of nature, always just does it. It's springtime and the hellebores are out in the gardens and they're gorgeous. And they happen every February. And the frogs start singing again and it's amazing. And it gets milder and I've had that first tingling of being working in my garden in sunshine on my face again. Oh, it's spring again. for instance, like, and this completely reliable, however else it's crazy and everything, and maybe it's too early and lots of things, it absolutely happens. The eagles always come back in January and December, for instance. Or maybe there's, you know, somebody in your life who was really solidly there for you, who's, you know, who's passed on perhaps, who isn't around, but you've had an experience of something that's really reliable. Loyalty. Why, you know, wedding vows, one of the vows is like, I, you know, will be loyal. People aren't that reliable, and we all know about wedding vows and what happens, and it can change. But there is a period of trusting. It may be a long period if you're fortunate. But that feeling, my daughter's with a guy who is really a loyal person. It's one of his main characteristics, and she knows it, and she has that feeling, and it's a lovely feeling. Not whether the thing itself is absolutely trustworthy, but the experience of trusting is what we're trying to access here. And so we're using whatever contents of your life you can, that you can trust. Another thing that's a really good practice to bring trust is, when you've meditated, and most of you have meditated some, this is called insight meditation. This is called the Seattle Insight Meditation Center. This is an insight. When you have an insight in your experience, you trust it. You know it's true, and you know it's good, and you understand that it is helpful. Go to your insights. Like, just recall an insight. Or not just the insight itself, but the impact of the insight. That feeling of like, oh gosh, yeah. I'm not my thoughts. Thoughts are just thoughts, you know, they're not the truth of things. It's just what my mind is saying. It's different. And you know that's true, and you feel that certainty, that conviction. That's what I mean by trusting. And that allays this hindrance of doubting, which is that insecure feeling. And so how can you access this for yourself? And one more piece that's really useful to reflect on that helps us with this confidence feeling, this trusting feeling, is to have handled, somebody asked a question last night, to have handled difficulty. As we meditate, we discover that we can turn towards unpleasantness or pain or grief. The question last night was about heartache, you know. We can turn towards and let in the pain, and we can cope with it. And we discover, if we can just quietly, calmly experience it, it becomes workable. We can tolerate it. We didn't think we could, we were scared of it, we did everything to try and help ourselves not feel it, which didn't help it, we just got all wound up. We can quietly, mindfully experience sadness and discover it's actually quite manageable. That gives huge confidence. You know, I can be with difficulty. It's not that solid. It's going to shift. I'll have another moment where I'm feeling bored or I'm feeling grateful or something, and then I'm really sad again. That's trustworthy. That capacity you now have, you know you have, if you have had such an insight. So that's a useful reflection for trust.